glanced around, looking for Adisla's brothers to see if they could talk some reason into Disa. They weren't there, though. Gone away to Nidani's as part of Forkbeard's advance guard to prepare the way for the meeting of kings before midsummer.
"I won't let this happen," said Vali to Disa.
"It's for the best. You love her now, but will you offer her the security a husband can when she's old? Will you—"
He didn't wait for her to finish speaking. Forkbeard's hall was a good distance inland, but he arrived there in a heartbeat. The king was hearing a dispute between two farmers when Vali burst in. The farmers recognized him and withdrew to the side of the room. Another man, further down the hall, stood up as Vali entered. He was tall, young, and powerfully built. His clothes were out of the ordinary. He wore a bright white silk shirt, the like of which Vali had only ever seen in the possession of the trader Veles Libor. Vali thought that perhaps he recognized him, but the thought was fleeting. He approached the king and bowed. Forkbeard, one of those squat, strong men who gives the impression of being wider than he is tall, was slurping at a bowl of soup and getting much of it down his beard. He was a tough man who'd come to kingship through fighting his way there. His court was not one of intrigue and debate, but a place where, to carry an argument, you had to outfight or outdrink your opponent, preferably both.
"If, Prince, you're here again with some fancy plan about how we can win battles without fighting, then save your breath. A man goes into war thinking only of his foe to his front and his friend at his side, not weighed down with schemes. Raid and fight or stay put, that's the deal. Take it or leave it, and don't ask me again. We've been here too many times before, haven't we, lads?"
A couple of the bodyguard nodded and said that they had. Vali had repeatedly annoyed Forkbeard with his contention that planning could win a battle more effectively than direct attack. Forkbeard had always just asked him where glory fitted into his schemes.
"I have not come about that." "Then what is it?" "I want you to release me from my marriage pact with your daughter. I am not the son you want, and the Rhaegir deserve a better, stronger prince than me."
Forkbeard snorted.
"You're right there, son."
Vali's heart skipped. The king lifted his beard and licked the soup off it. He seemed to ponder for a moment.
"But forget it. Too many questions if I release you. Half the kings along the coast would think I was planning to have a go at Orthon. And worse still, so might he. That is a war-loving fellow indeed, ain't that right, lads?"
The bodyguard said that it was.
"My father will not take offence, and he has not raised a sword these 10 years.
Even though Forkbeard was not given to niceties, Vali instinctively gave him the respect of high speech.
"Too long for a man like that," said Forkbeard. "I tell you, son, if I could think of a way to stop this marriage, then I would. Your children will be weaklings. But what can I do?"
"Find another prince, lord."
Forkbeard shook his head.
"Your old dad wouldn't like it," he said. "But, as it happens, there might be a way out after all. Hongni, get up here."
The young man in the silk shirt came forward and bowed to Vali and Forkbeard.
"Hongni, son of Morthy," he said. "Messenger to King Orthon."
So that was where Vali had seen him, at Orthon's court.
"Tell the prince what his father has said."
The man bowed again and looked slightly nervous.
"Go on," said Forkbeard. "No one gets the chop here without my leave. It's me who's asked you to speak to him, so say what Orthon told you. If the prince wants to pick a fight about it, he can pick one with me. And that's a bit of trouble he won't want, I can tell you."
"That's right," said a bodyguard.
Hongni glanced at Forkbeard, and then addressed Vali precisely and formally.
Exalted King Forkbeard, Terror of the South, Mighty in Battle, Lord of the Rhaegir. Know that it is my wish that my idle son be shaken from his life of ease. Reports tell me that he ignores arms, counsel, and raiding in favour of conversation with women. Let him prove himself. The land to the north of our kingdoms is beset by bandits. Merchants, shepherds, and farmers all fear attack from the savage men who plague the Troll Mountains. Truly, these men are wolves, sorcerers, able to assume the form of that monstrous animal, striking down with fury and viciousness all that cross them, invulnerable to weapons, and murderous in intent. Seven of my own men have died trying to wipe out this scourge. My son will bring you the head of one before midsummer. If he does not, then I leave it to you to impose a meaningful penalty.
Vali looked at the man, and then back to Forkbeard.
Why this? Why now?
Who are you whying?
Said Forkbeard. Vali ignored his belligerence.
It makes no difference to my request. Release me from the pact with your daughter and allow Adisla to marry me, or at least forbid her from marrying anyone else.
Forkbeard looked to the rafters.
That form girl is the cause of all the bother in my life. I have less problems with the bastard Danes than I do with her.
He lowered his eyes and stared straight at Vali.
Return with a wolfman's head. No, better for proof, the whole man. Or your Adisla is Odin's bride at the Summer Blurt. She'll hang to please the god.
Vali went pale. The bride of Odin was a tradition almost never celebrated in individual kingdoms. He had heard that on great feast days, when kings from all over the land met for a festival, a blurt, there were human sacrifices. But Forkbeard had never insisted on one before.
You can't do this, said Vali.
Forkbeard sipped from a jeweled drinking cup, booty from a raid. Vali thought of the Odin blind berserks and the needless deaths they had caused, thought of the stupid frenzy that had exposed his kinsmen to danger and the valuable slave hanged on the returning boat. One day he would drink Odin's blood, tear that god down, and make him pay for his corpse lust.
Can't I?
Said Forkbeard. He leaned forward and said in a forceful whisper,
I might have to go run into the assembly to get my laws passed, but religion is my turf, and mine alone.
Now he stood and shouted,
I'm the king, the top boy, Odin's priest on earth, bargaining with the god, telling all you lot what he wants for his favours. Do you get that?
He sat again, but he was pointing at Vali.
Well, he wants this girl for his bride, unless you bring him the head of his enemy, the Wolfman. Your father reckons you've got what it takes. I don't. We'll see who's right. I expect you'll die even before you get to the Wolfman, which will suit me down to the ground, as I'll be able to get someone with a bit of balls about him for my daughter. And you'll have the consolation of knowing that your form girl will be filling your cup in the halls of the slain. You can't take a freeborn woman and sacrifice her. The people will know she didn't volunteer,
said Vali. Forkbeard shook his head.
She's a threat to the kingdom, lad. And it's you who's made her one. The people will understand why she had to die. And if the gods want to stop it, then they'll bring you success. Seems straight enough to me. What don't you understand?
Vali stood shaking. He wanted to shout that if Adisla died, it wouldn't be the head of the wolf that he presented to the people of Rogaland, but that of Forkbeard himself. But he saw now how stupid he had been, how artless. He should have hidden his true thoughts from others, participated in their chaotic attacks, bragged about the slaughter of old men and boys. As a respected warrior, he would be in a much better position. Forkbeard would treat him seriously, would ban Adisla's marriage, at least. He wouldn't even need to ban it. If word of his displeasure reached the prospective groom's house, he would never go through with his suit. Now, this. And what if he couldn't find the wolfman? His only option would be to challenge Forkbeard to single combat. He was confident he could survive on a battlefield, but a one-on-one duel with a man who had cut his way to kingship was a different thing. Never mind. If Forkbeard tried to harm Adisla, then Vali would defend her. "This is a perilous course for all of us," said Vali.
"Perilous courses are my favourite sort," said Forkbeard. "Remember, kings are made for glory, not long life."
Vali tried to reply with something like he would have said to Bragi. "If you have the wit, you can combine both, or you seem to have lived to a respectable age." But the words seemed lodged in his throat.
"I'm up at the Assembly of Kings at Nidanis until midsummer. It is a month. Return with the wolfman by then, or watch your form, girl, hang," said Forkbeard.
"And then will you excuse me marrying your daughter?"
"Not a chance. You'll have proved yourself a great warrior. Your girl'll live, that's all. Now get out of here before I change my mind on that one, too."
Vali saw how he had been forced into a situation where the best he could hope for was that things would remain as they had been. The worst, well, that wasn't going to happen. The chances of finding wolfmen, let alone capturing one, were terribly slim. A different plan was needed. Adisla would have to marry her farmer immediately. That would make it much more difficult for Forkbeard to take her as a sacrifice. It would mean they would never be together, but she would live. And he would still have to go on his mission. He was sure he wouldn't return. For the second time that day, he ran the distance between Forkbeard's hall and Adisla's house, pushing himself ever faster. Halfway there, he heard hooves behind him. Three riders of the king's bodyguard, their purpose clear. They were riding bareback, with only bridles on the horses. They hadn't had time to saddle up, because they were trying to beat him to the farm. The horses slowed as they approached. They were on a narrow track through trees, and he moved to bar their path.
"You stop there!" shouted Vali. "As a prince, I command you to stop!"
The horses drew up. The riders were armed, one with a sword and two with spears, but he felt sure they wouldn't attack him. The swordsman drew his weapon and pointed it at Vali. It was Aegir, who had told him the news of Adisla's marriage in the first place.
"Where are your arms, prince?"
"Ah, but you are Vali the Swordless, hearthhugger and thrall friend, aren't you? How do you propose to stop us? With the words you learn from the women? Or are you going to speak our enemy's language at us?"
The other two laughed, though slightly nervously. Vali was, after all, a prince, and they knew very well that at some point he might have the power of life and death over them. Vali was desperate.
"I'll pay you to let me go first. On oath, you'll have money if you do so."
Where Vali would get this money from, he didn't know. Maybe he could sell the helmet his father had given him, if he could get it back off Bragi.
"We are sworn defenders of the king," said a spearman. "There is no money that can sway us from his orders."
He urged his horse forward at a trot. As he came past, Vali lunged for him, grabbing his tunic and pulling him from the animal's back. The horse was spooked and bolted, streaming the reins behind it. The other two kicked their mounts forward and around the pair, brawling on the ground.
"See you at the slut's house!"
shouted Aggie at her as he passed. Vali jumped up in useless desperation. The bodyguard followed him and dusted himself down.
"A fair smack, Prince. Weapon or no weapon, I grant you that," he said.
Then he looked to the ground.
"I'm sorry for what's happened to her. She's a fine girl. Save your words for your horse," said Vali, turning to run through the trees to the farm.
She was gone, of course, when he arrived. Disa was waiting in the doorway. He had never seen her so angry.
"What have you done?" she said.
Vali felt hot and wretched.
"How is she? Where have they taken her?"
"She's at Forkby, it's all. She's perfectly well, and likely to remain so until they hang her. What are you going to do about it, boy? What are you going to do?"
Vali's body felt full of energy. He was bursting to go somewhere, to do something, to make it all go away. But even as he said the words, they sounded unconvincing.
"I'll do as Forkby demands. I'll find the wolfman."
"How?"
I'll go north and walk around until they attack me."
For the first time in his life, Vali saw Disa's eyes fill with tears.
"You'll do nothing of the sort, you useless fool. There'll be two of you dead if you do."
"Then I'll go to Forkbeard's hall and fight him for her."
"You'll fight Forkbeard, a man who killed his first enemy at 12, and who has murdered more people than you have ever seen. You fight Forkbeard, you'll..."
She wiped her eyes. Bragi was watching from where he was sitting beneath a tree. He had decided long ago that the best way to keep an eye on the prince was to spend time at Disa's himself.
"You, old man, you go with him."
"I was told the order yesterday, madam. The boy is to go alone."
"You knew, and sat there drinking at my table."
"I knew he was to go. I knew nothing of the fate of your girl, on my oath."
Disa composed herself.
"Will you lend him your sword, at least? It's the best blade in the kingdom."
"It would be my dearest wish," said Bragi.
"Then come on," said Disa. "We have no time to waste. Come inside."
"I need to go now. I need to find this wolfman," said Vali.
"That," said Disa, "is exactly what we are going to do. Get Mar Yordis. We have work to do."
Chapter 11. An Invitation. Word of what was happening spread throughout the little farmsteads, and curiosity drew a crowd. They packed into Disa's house so tightly that she had to drive some of them outside. While they waited for Yordis to come, Disa took a pack from her shelf and began to stuff it with food, bread, some cheese, honey in a pot sealed with cloth, and other things. She was talking as much to herself as to Vali.
"You'll need food, for a little way at least, and something to light your fire. I'll put in some webs and yarra for wounds. The honey's not to be eaten. You can put that on any cuts you get, too. Long root will give strength to your blood, and mint will keep you watchful. This," she said, holding up a small flask, "is to be taken in small quantities when you are well hidden and sure to be safe from enemies. It will help you sleep through the white nights, no matter how hard the bed, though you need no more than a drop. 5 drops in a man's glass will see him sleep so soundly he cannot be woken for a day. You may need to resort to such measures if you're hard-pressed. Here is wolfsbane to take away pain, again only a drop. Now, what else?"
As she scoured her shelves, Bragi came in with his sword. Disa took it from him without a word and put it next to the pack. All the time, Vali was stewing in his shame. He had condemned Adisla to death because he had considered only himself, not her.
"This," said Mar Disa,
holding open a small bag of mushrooms and dried flowers, "is what the berserks use. Boil it with water, and drink it as hot as you can bear." Vali was going to protest, to say he didn't want anything to do with berserker magic. He couldn't really see a situation where he would have time for what amounted to cooking before a fight, but he thought, best take it and be grateful. Yodis came in, smacking him hard over the back of the head.
"I heard. You're a fool, prince, and the gods help the Horde if you ever become their king."
Mar Yodis was a big, bustling woman with arms like pork hams, and the blow hurt. Vali accepted it, though. He'd known her since he was a small child, and almost regarded it as her right to cuff him around the ears if she wanted to. The women exchanged a long look.
"Begin," said Yodis.
Disa nodded. The women went to the centre of the room and started work, stoking up the fire, moving goats, chickens, benches and stools out of the way, pushing the curious to where they would cause least interference. They brought in a table, which was positioned very close to the fire. On the table was placed a chest, pulled through the throng of onlookers. As this was done, Disa shook down her hair. Yodis caught it up in her hands, tying it at the back in three tight knots. Vali shivered. He knew what they were. The hanging knots of the dead lord's necklace, symbol of Odin, the god he had come to hate. The women's actions were accompanied by a whispered commentary, as those who could see passed news of what was happening to those who could not.
"She's tying her hair. She's becoming the bride of Odin. If she hangs herself, then the god might save the girl. That terrible fellow wants someone to swing, no mistake. He is the lord of the hanged, a mighty god indeed."
"Don't be stupid. Mardisa's death won't save the girl."
Some voices praised Odin almost ecstatically. Others were quieter, but disapproving of what they saw. The poorer people, those who had the hard pasture and mean dwellings, thought that destiny lay in the hands of the gods. The richer farmers, or those who had enjoyed successful raiding, were more inclined to say they had made their own luck, and put less trust in the divine. Yodis pushed the chest to the front of the table, and Disa sat on it, her head slightly above those of the standing crowd, her feet only just above the fire. Yodis took Vali by the arm and sat him on the floor on the other side of the fire, looking up at Disa. Vali glanced around at the watching faces, long in the light of the flames. It was as if he was at the centre of some strange clearing in the forest, the people hanging over him like twisted trees.
"Them that don't have to be here shouldn't be here for the next bit. You'll be in for a long night," said Yodis.
But no one moved. She pushed through the crowd, took a pot from a shelf at the back of the room, removed a stone serving as its lid, and shook something into her hand that looked to Vali like kindling. Yodis threw the stuff onto the fire, and it began to burn, releasing an acrid and unpleasant smoke. Most of those nearest to it, Vali included, pulled their tunics up over their mouths and noses, but Disa breathed deeply, and intoned in a strange, high voice,
"I speak the rune of the spell god. I howl the rune of the hanged god. Odin, who lost his eye for lore. Odin, waiting mind blown by the well."
Disa then produced a piece of wood and marked something on it, Vali couldn't see what, with three strokes of her knife. She put the wood on her knees and held the knife to her palm. She drew in breath, steeling herself, and then made the same three strokes in her hand, but much quicker. Vali recognized the Anzu's rune and was fascinated. He could carve runes himself and knew they were said to have magical properties. He'd asked Disa to tell him what they were, but she had just said that kings and warriors made their magic cutting runes on the bodies of their enemies, and had no need for further knowledge. The blood dripped from Deesa's hand down onto the wood. She smeared it into what she had carved there, and then threw it onto the fire.
"What am I? I am a woman. Where am I? At the hearth. What am I? I am a woman. Where am I? At the hearth. What am I? I am a woman. Where am I? At the hearth. What am I? I am a woman. Where am I? At the hearth."
Yodis came to Deesa's side and bound her hand, but she seemed not to notice. She continued to chant, eyes vacant and staring into space. Her voice seemed to deaden Vali's sense of time. He saw the fire restocked both with logs and with the strange herbs by Yodis, and then old Ma Sefa returned with more of each.
"What am I? I am a woman. Where am I? At the hearth. What am I? I am a woman. Where am I? At the hearth."
Again and again she said the words, rocking slightly on the chest, as Vali looked up at her through the fire and the smoke. Sometimes his mind wandered, and he thought that she had stopped, but when he came back to himself she was still chanting. How long had he sat there? He couldn't tell, but his legs were numb and his head was heavy. The smoke filled up Vali's senses. Tiredness descended on him, but he was not allowed to sleep. Every time he began to drift off, Yodis or Sefa would shake him as they roused Deesa. The purpose of her seat became clear. It was uncomfortable and precarious, virtually impossible to doze on. Then Vali noticed the room was lighter and colder. Some people had left. In fact, many people had left. Looking over to the doorway, he realized he had completely missed the brief night, and the light was that of the dawn. Around them the farmers came and went, chatting, speculating on how Deesa worked her art, wondering what enchantment she was laying on Vali. Some said that she was trying to make him invulnerable to weapons, some that she would turn him into a bird to scour the land for the wolfmen, some that she was pleased her daughter was going to Odin and would frustrate Vali in his quest. A couple began to play at dice. Others picked up Vali's king's table set and played that, bored by the ritual, but afraid they might miss something if they went home. Two young men even started to mock Deesa, repeating her words in silly high voices. Yodis sent them packing with a whack from a broom. Late arrivers, religious women of the outlying farms, came and joined in the chant, hoping to gain the blessing of the god Deesa was seeking.
"What am I? I am a woman. Where am I? At the hearth. What am I? I am a woman. Where am I? At the hearth."
The chanting never stopped. The light outside grew brighter. It was hot again, and then it was cold again. More people came in, others left. Yodis shook Vali awake, shook Deesa awake, steadying her on her platform, throwing more herbs on the fire.
"What am I? I do not know. Where am I? In the dark. What am I? I am a raven. Where am I? On the field of the slain. What am I? I am ravens. Where am I? Where I can see."
Was she really saying that? Vali wondered. The ground seemed to rock as if he was on a ship. The air seemed thick and clinging. The light outside was weakening once more. Neither Vali nor Deesa had slept in 3 days. Deesa's voice was cracked, hardly audible. Something cut through the fog of his thoughts. Disa was coughing and spluttering. Then she let out a scream and began to shiver violently. Yodis and Sefer leapt to her side, holding her on the chest. Disa's body went rigid. It seemed almost as if she would lift off her seat.
"These pins are so sharp in my skin."
Disa had spoken, but in a way that Vali had never heard her speak before. Slow and deliberate, much higher than her normal tone, and with a strange accent. Vali looked up at her, his legs stone with sitting, his mind like a boulder.
"A rune I took from the tormented god."
It was a tremulous voice, almost like that of a child, thought Vali. On some sounds it seemed to draw and suck like the sea on shingle, but on others cracked and choked like the noise of a dog with a chicken bone. Disa threw herself back and sat down heavily on the table, the chest going crashing to the side. Her body convulsed, but then the shivering subsided and she became calm. Yodis and Sefer let her go, and she stood on the table looking out across the room. The temperature in the room plummeted, and Vali felt his skin prickle into goosebumps. His breath froze on the air in front of him. There was something in Mardisa's manner that was quite unlike her. She stood tall and proud, surveying her surroundings like a queen. The people drew back from her, a couple giving involuntary cries. A patina of frost had formed at her feet. Vali was sure he was seeing magic working before his eyes. He was right. But it no longer had anything to do with Disa. Chapter 12. Enemies. The Witch Queen had sensed the first death, like someone dozing on a summer day might sense a cloud go over the sun. Things had moved quickly then. Candles had been lit to pierce the tomb dark of the caves, sisters disturbed from their ritual sufferings, boys dispatched to find the corpse. Orthon was not yet back home from the wall with the infant Vali when Gulveig located the first body. The girl was lying in the lower tunnels, close to the wet rocks, near the deep pool where the rite of the water rune was performed. She was hanged, a rough rope thrown over a jutting rock, a triple knot tied at the neck. The Witch Queen had touched the girl's cold smile, and then the rope. She knew what those knots meant, the three tight interlocking triangles. The dead lord's necklace, sign of the god Odin, the berserk, the hanged, the drowned, the wise and the mad. The god to whom she had dedicated her life. The Witch Queen touched the white of the girl's throat, her magic-widened senses drinking in the resonances of the child's death. The bruises had the sense of a delicious stain, she thought, blackberries and dark wine. She took up the girl's hair in her fingers and breathed in. Baked bread, cinders, straw bedding and dried flowers were the odours of her death. The girl had gone home. It was a suicide, Gulveig was sure. The dead child had not been unhappy. She had been scared when she had first entered the caves, but the presence of the queen, at 12 years old, a child herself, had reassured her, and the witches had touched her mind to bring her calm. The pain and suffering of the rituals had not come easily to her, but she had endured, seen the aim, felt her mind widening as her grip on sanity loosened. She was to have been the inheritor of the rune of water, to carry the resonance of that ancient symbol within her, to sustain it and be sustained by it. Two girls had been trained. When the old witch, who was their mentor, died, it would be decided who would nurture the rune and who would participate in lesser rituals, to help, to fetch and carry. Now there was only one girl to continue the magic. If anything happened to her, the rune would cease to manifest in the physical realm, and the sister's power would diminish. There was something else Gullveig could sense in the magical signature of the girl's death, a feeling of heaviness. The heaviness someone drowning feels as their clothes fill with water, the heaviness of a downward current as it sucks the strength from a swimmer's limbs. There was a magical presence there, the witch could tell, and it had flowed from the rune the girl had been given to learn. That should not have happened. The witches had suffered losses before, but they had been physical ones. Sisters frozen, smothered, or suffocated by smoke when a ritual had gone wrong. The runes had been within their control for generations, until that day. The witch leaned forward and tapped her tongue on the girl's cheek. The taste was of ocean depths, sightless and empty voids. Gullveig felt the pulling tides, the tug of groping blind sea beasts, the weight of waters above her, all seeming to say, "Come lower, descend, lose sight of the light, and give yourself to this heavy darkness." She shivered. There would be more of these deaths, she knew. As certain as people of lesser sensitivities know that one wave follows another. The following years proved her right. Sometimes there were no deaths from one summer to the next. In others, there might be two. Knowledge of the girl's passing came to the Witch Queen in different ways. One death presented itself as a lurch in the consciousness, like when you suddenly pull back from the brink of sleep. Another came as a feeling of disquiet from a dream that didn't stop when she woke. Still another arrived like the taste of tar in the back of her mouth, a nausea that she could not shake until she saw the corpse. Gullveig held their pale bodies in her arms, touched the bruises at their necks, put her fingers to their swollen lips, stroked their broken limbs, and felt an unbearable pressure in her head. Loki had told her the truth, she thought. Odin was acting against her, killing her sisters. She was certain of one thing. This creeping harvest was only a prelude. Odin would not be content taking one or two lives, nibbling away at her power from the shadows. He was coming, as himself, and in force. It had taken her nearly 16 years to find him, which did not surprise her. If the god did not know himself, then it would take a huge effort for a mortal to identify him. She had managed it, through the old and trusted ways, meditation, ritual, and suffering. At first his presence had been elusive in her mind, glimpsed like the glimmer of a fish in water, gone almost as soon as it was there. But over weeks and months, in waking and sleeping, she had tracked him, through her agony-induced trances. She saw herself wandering under the empty spaces of the northern evening, until, so startling they shook her from her trance, she saw a pair of pale blue eyes looking at her from a field of snow, and heard the lonely howl of a wolf. It was him, the god, appearing in just a fleeting vision, but it was all that she needed. She was on his trail. She did not see, and could only barely sense, the pale woman with the ruined face, who watched her in her meditations. She knew, though, that there was a presence who walked at her side, hating her, just out of sight. It was that presence that guided her. All the queen could tell was that something travelled with her in her meditations, and seemed to know what would harm her. She had sensed its excitement rising when she had caught sight of Odin. The witch did not find this particularly disturbing. She had lived all her life alongside strange entities, faces that flickered from the firelight, shadows on rock that seemed to glower with carnivorous intent. Sleeping or waking, she was never far from the suffocating spirits of the dark. The thing that followed her now was at least useful. the closer its attention, the nearer she was to the greatest harm of all, Odin. A year after she had seen the eyes looking at her from the snow, her unseen hater had led her to Disa, and so back to him. The witch queen had almost ignored Disa's call. She was so caught up in the search for her enemy, the god. It was the fourth day of her hanging ordeal, her flesh pierced by thick pins secured by cords to a slab overhanging a scree slope in a steep cave near the surface. Disa's words had come to her on a wisp of smoke from the cold air at the top of the wall. Entreaties from village healers and wise women were not common. Such women knew the risks of invoking the witch's attention, but they were distracting when they came. But as Gullveig prepared to dismiss the call, she felt an interest from the thing at her side. Here, it seemed, was harm, and therefore, perhaps, Odin. The witch allowed her mind to float up over the grey rock, to mingle with the smoke, and use it as a road to carry her back to its source. In her house, Disa breathed in the herb-laced fire, and with it, consciousness of the witch. She shook and trembled, throwing herself back off the chest. Then things became hazy, she felt terribly drowsy, and she had the sense that her body was not her own. There was an odd presence prowling through her head. As Gullveig looked out through the healer's eyes, she could see the room with the faces of the villagers gaping back at her. She could also see the youth at her feet. She knew him straight away. The wolf's brother. The ingredient. The holy victim. But there was someone else there, too. At her side she saw a woman who she thought she remembered, beautiful, but with a terribly burned face. In front of her, his form insubstantial and spectral in the firelight, was the god. He was beating a shallow drum with a bone stick. His eyes were piercing, and on his head he wore a four-cornered blue hat. The drum was painted with runes, and as he beat it, they seemed to fall from it, shaking to the floor and collecting at his feet, before disappearing like snowflakes on warm autumn ground.
"Lord Odin," said the witch.
She knew exactly where she was. That space that wasn't a space, a nexus called into being by ritual, where sorcerers and spirits from remote and distant locations could allow their consciousnesses to assemble. The physical form of the woman with the burned face and that of the sorcerer might be miles from the house, but their magical selves were there. The woman with the burned face extended her hand towards her, and Gullveig took it, as if for reassurance. The god spoke to her. His language was strange, as was the name he called her, but she understood him perfectly.
"Yavmeaka, the wolf is ours. We have seen your intent, and you will not prevail."
There was a murmur of assent, but it didn't come from the people in the room. Others were collaborating with the god, she thought. The witch was terrified by his presence, but she thought she had a chance. If the god did not know he was a god, then he may not yet have come to his full power. That meant he could be defeated in magic, or at least beaten back. She sent her mind like a belch towards the blue-eyed man. Poisonous stink of rot, mould, worms, and the crawling things of the earth that spewed forward to engulf him. It wasn't even really a spell, just an opening of her consciousness, a little glimpse of the places she had been and what she had seen there, enough to cook the brain of anyone who had not walked at least some of those paths themselves. But something came back, a rhythm, an insistent beat that clouded her thoughts and made her long for sleep. She heard a strange, rough singing, felt a blast of cold, saw white fields of snow, creatures thin as runes moving across them, and she longed to step into that cold, Gulveig, however, was not a wise woman with potions and chants, a village seer or ragged prophet. She was the witch queen of the Troll Wall, lady of the shrieking runes, a creature born and raised to magic. She did not step into the cold. Instead, her mind on the edge of disaster, a rune expressed itself in her. A rune like the point of a spear, its steel tip gleaming as it flew across a clear blue sky. The drumming burst to a frenzy. Raised voices became shouting. She had a taste in her throat, ash and sour milk, the smell of funeral fires. And when she looked again, the blue-eyed man was gone. Had she killed him? She doubted it. But there were others about him, and she sensed they had suffered from her attack. Odin had felt weak to her, far from his full power. So he could not yet move against her. So what had he done? The girl with the ravaged face who sat by her side in the hanging cave stroked her hand, and the answer came to Gulveig in an instant. He hadn't the power yet to take on any of the witches directly, so he was working where he could, at the girls who were being prepared to inherit the runes. If they died, then there would be no women to continue the witches' traditions. Gulveig would eventually be left alone and isolated. While his strength grew, hers would diminish. She saw it was time to accelerate the pace of the magic. The wolf boy had been prepared. Now he had to meet his holy victim, the prince. What is magic? Disa had sought to unite the wolfman with the prince, so had called the witch. The witch had decided it was time to begin the spell to make her werewolf, and so to bring the wolfman and the prince together. Was that a coincidence? Had this conjunction been caused by Disa's ritual, or was it an expression of the witch's far more powerful magic, which worked away in her deep mind without needing to come to consciousness? Or had it come about through the strongest magic of all, that woven by the fates? Whatever it was, Gulveig's desire was now in harmony with Disa's, and it found expression in a spell. Gulveig reached through Disa to touch Vali. Vali forced his heavy eyes open to watch as Disa's body convulsed again. She coughed and shook, shivered and growled. Then she dropped onto the floor by Vali and crouched in front of him. She leaned forward, taking his face in her hands. Vali looked into her eyes and was afraid. It wasn't Disa looking at him, he knew, but something far stranger. And whatever it was exuded cold. Vali felt her hands freezing on his face. The witch, hanging from the torture rock, tried to work her spell, but Disa's mind was inadequate to channeling her magic, too fastened to everyday reality. The healer needed to be sent somewhere that would banish her day-to-day consciousness completely and allow Gulveig to work through her. Vali looked into Disa's eyes. He could smell something. Burning. Disa, he realized, had pushed the edge of her skirt into the fire, almost surreptitiously, trying to avoid detection until the last moment. The material caught, and the room filled with light and movement and noise. Yodis pulled Disa from the fire. Then people were on her, beating at her skirts, trying to extinguish the flames. But Disa was holding them off with one hand, extending the other towards Vali and hissing something under her breath. Two of the men got her down, someone else threw water, but still Disa fixed her eyes on Vali. Vali felt a cold enter his mind, a creeping feeling of damp and dark. He fell back. Something had gone into him. It felt as though he had a toad stuck in his throat, a clammy, writhing thing that would not be coughed out. The only way to get rid of the hideous feeling was to stand, to go. He was overwhelmed by tiredness, but not sleepy. He got to his feet. His sympathy for Deesa was like something on the tip of his tongue, known but distant beneath the nausea he was feeling. He had to move, he knew that. It was like the frustration of being trapped indoors through a long winter storm, dying to get outside but knowing it is impossible, but magnified many times. He went to the back of the room, where Bragi had hung his sword next to his pack. He picked up both and left. No one followed him. They were all attending to Deesa or watching her being attended to. It was the long twilight of the northern summer. The sky was a pale silver, and a big moon hung alongside a single bright star. Already, Vali noticed, the moon was not quite full. He had less than a month to save Adisla. A large crow flapped from one tree to another, and Vali's body seemed to respond to the movement. Tired beyond thought, he saw himself start walking and noticed that he was going east along the shore of the fjord. Only his forward movement seemed to stop the nausea inside him. After that, he seemed to forget that he was travelling at all. His movements seemed automatic, unconscious, and unguided, as he took the road from the village, only dimly aware of his surroundings. He was lost in a trance of thoughts of Adisla, of Deesa, of the cold eyes of whatever had looked through her, and he didn't really notice where he was until he woke. He stood up, shook the moisture from himself, and looked around. There was a depression in the grass. He had slept there, it seemed. It was dusk again. He checked his pack and his sword and looked to the distance. A dark blue range of mountains split the horizon, and he knew that was where he needed to go. The feeling of sickness was still with him, and he thought that he wouldn't bother with food, just go on until he found his wolfman. He was high up on one side of a steep valley on a slope that, within yards of where he had woken, fell away as a cliff. He moved to the edge and peered down. There were two riders below him, and they had made a camp. The men had laid blankets beneath a heavily leafed alder tree and made a small fire. They were preparing to sleep, he thought, taking advantage of the shelter of the tree. One of them was Orthon's messenger, Hongni. Vali looked up at the mountains. A horse would halve his journey time. He dimly sensed he was enchanted and wondered if that was why his thoughts had suddenly come to clarity. Did the spell, or whatever was controlling the spell, want him to take a horse to speed him forward? The men hadn't seen him. It occurred to him to simply walk down the hill and command them to give him their horses. They were, after all, his father's retainers, and so owed him a duty of obedience. But his father had ordered that he should be tested against the wolfmen. Would they agree to give up their animals? And what was to stop them killing him right there if they felt like it? There were other people, cousins and uncles, with claims to Orthon's throne. If one of these men was of their party, Vali thought, they could run a spear through him and go home with no one any the wiser. His hand instinctively went to his sword. Then he lay flat and waited for the men to sleep. Chapter 13. The King's Men. An hour after the men lay down, Vali felt it safe to move. It was just dark, that splinter of night that pricks the long days of the northern summer. A bright moon, full save a slice of darkness on its right-hand side, shone down from a sky of deep stars. He imagined it as the eye of a sleepy god. By the time it had closed to nothing and opened to fullness again, Adisla would be dead, unless he could succeed. His task wasn't straightforward. He needed to steal at least one saddle and a bridle from the sleeping men without waking them up. Then he had to get to the horses. Catching them would be easy, because resting travellers always hobbled their horses by tying a foreleg to a back leg, which prevented the animals from moving faster than a walk. But he knew well that a horse might object, and noisily, to being saddled by a strange rider. He made his way down the slope as quietly as he could. There was no cover, and the glaring moon caught him in its bare light, so he had to rely on the men remaining asleep. Vali recognized the other sleeper when he got closer. Ori, one of his father's retainers, who he had seen on his rare visits to Orthon's court. His mind was emerging from the effects of the tiredness and the smoke he had inhaled, and he wondered why the men were travelling by land during summer. Merchants seeking to avoid pirates made the journey overland sometimes, and so did herders and those who needed to travel but couldn't afford a boat, but nearly everyone who had the choice went by sea. Only when the rivers and lakes froze did the land offer a quicker journey than the water. You'd have to be mad or enchanted to walk if you could sail. Vali crept past the smouldering campfire and found a saddle and bridle. He had never quite considered just how much metal was on these items before, or the row they made when they moved. They made such a clinking and creaking that they seemed less like horse tack and more like musical instruments. If he was a real thief, he would have found it easier just to kill the men in their sleep, he thought. With great care, he withdrew to where the horses were grazing. The animals were well trained, and he had no difficulty approaching one of them, a squat and sturdy beast that looked up to a long ride. He saddled it up as quickly as he could, with half an eye on the sleeping men. The horse made no sound beyond a brief cough of complaint as he tightened the girth on its out-breath. Then he bent to undo the rope that connected the horse's left legs. It was when he stood that he felt the hand on his shoulder.
"You'll be mistaken for a wolfman, prowling around like that, Prince."
He span round to see the face of Hongni grinning into his. For a moment he didn't know what to say. The man broke the silence with a laugh and called out,
"Ori! Fetch Prince Vali a drink. He must be parched after his long walk."
By the fire, which he was stirring to life, Ori waved and picked up a wineskin. Nausea swept over Vali, the taste of Deezer's smoke herbs returning to his throat. He wanted to be away, desperately, but it was more than a natural desire to get on with his mission. It was all he could do, not to run northwards. He was certain he was under some spell.
"A drink isn't necessary. I'll just take the horse," said Vali. "Relax, Prince. I have good news for you. Your father doesn't require you to kill any wolfmen."
"That wasn't what you said at Forkbeard's Hall."
"No, but what is said in a hall is not always matched by what happens outside it."
"I don't understand you."
"It was a deception."
"Call it by its name. A lie."
"It is not manly to lie."
Vali's head was swimming. The desire to leave was becoming overwhelming.
"I was delivering a message, and the message was not sent by your father. It was sent by your mother, Queen Irsa. So indeed, it wasn't manly, being of a woman."
Vali focused his eyes on Hongni's face, trying to make his thoughts do the same.
"Since when does my mother handle my father's affairs?"
"For about 4 years now," said Hongni. He shifted from foot to foot and said, as if afraid the grass would hear him and carry the secret out down the valley,
"Your father is sick."
"In what way?" Vali's heart leapt. Was he about to inherit his kingdom? If so, he would send these men back to Forkbeard with a message that he should release Adisla immediately, or see Horda longships on his shores before winter. Hongni didn't reply.
"Likely to die?"
The taste of the herbs was strong in his mouth, the tickle in his throat vile. Unlikely to die. Vali guessed at the meaning behind the man's brief reply. Madness? Again, no answer.